Penguin Random House Audio presents Greek Lessons, a novel by Hung Gung. Translated by Deborah Smith and Emily Ye Wan. Read for you by Greta Jung and Earl T. Kim.
Chapter 1. As his dying wish, Borges requested the epitaph. He took the sword and laid the naked metal between them. He asked this of Maria Kodama, his beautiful younger wife and literary secretary, who had married Borges 2 months before he died, at the age of 87. He chose Geneva as the place of his passing. It was the city where he had spent his youth and where he now wanted to be buried. One researcher described that epitaph as a blue steel symbol. For him, the image of the blade was the key that would unlock the significance of Borges's writing. The knife that divides Borges's style from conventional literary realism. Whereas for me, it seemed an extremely quiet and private confession. The line was a quotation from a Norse saga. On the first night, a man and a woman spent together, which in this saga was also to be their last. A sword was placed between them and left there until dawn. If that blue steel blade was not the blindness that lay between the aging Borges and the world, then what was it? Though I'd traveled to Switzerland, I didn't visit Geneva. I had no strong desire to see his grave firsthand. Instead, I looked around the library of St. Gall, which he would have found endlessly enrapturing had he seen it. I recall the rough feeling of the felt slippers that visitors were given in order to protect the 1,000-year-old library's floor. Caught a boat at the wharf in Lucerne and floated through the valleys of ice-covered Alps until dusk. I didn't take any photographs. The sights were recorded only in my eyes, the sounds, smells, and tactile sensations that a camera cannot capture in any case were impressed on my ears, nose, face, and hands. There was not yet a knife between me and the world. So at the time, this was enough.
Chapter 2. Silence. The woman brings her hands together in front of her chest, frowns, and looks up at the blackboard.
Okay, read it out.
The man with a thick-lensed, silver-rimmed spectacle says with a smile. The woman's lips twitch. She moistens her lower lip with the tip of her tongue. In front of her chest, her hands are quietly restless. She opens her mouth and closes it again. She holds her breath, then exhales deeply. The man steps back toward the blackboard and patiently asks her again to read. The woman's eyelids tremble, like insects' wings, rubbing briskly together. The woman closes her eyes, reopens them, as if she hopes in the moment of opening her eyes to find herself transported to some other location. The man readjusts his glasses, his fingers thickly floured with white chalk.
Come on now, out loud.
The woman wears a high-necked black sweater and black trousers. The jacket she's hung on her chair is black, and the scarf she's put in her big black cloth bag is knitted from black wool. Above that somber uniform, which makes it seem as if she's just come from a funeral, her face is thin and drawn, like the elongated features of certain clay sculptures. She is a woman neither young nor particularly beautiful. Her eyes have an intelligent look, but the constant spasming of her eyelids makes this hard to perceive. Her back and shoulders are permanently drawn in, as though she is seeking refuge inside her black clothes, and her fingernails are clipped back severely. Around her left wrist is a dark purple velvet hairband, the solitary point of color on an otherwise monochrome figure.
Let's all read it together.
The man cannot wait for the woman any longer. He moves his gaze over the baby-faced university student who sits in the same row as the woman, the middle-aged man half hidden behind a pillar, and the well-set-up young man sitting by the window, slouching in his chair.
Hemos
Himeteros. My, our. The three students read, their voices low and shy. Sos, humeteros. You're singular. You're plural. The man standing by the blackboard looks to be in his mid to late 30s. He is slight, with eyebrows like bold accents over his eyes and a deep groove at the base of his nose. A faint smile of restrained emotion plays around his mouth. His dark brown corduroy jacket has fawn-colored leather elbow patches. The sleeves are a bit short, exposing his wrists. The woman gazes up at the scar that runs in a slender pale curve from the edge of his left eyelid to the edge of his mouth. When she'd seen it in their first lesson, she'd thought of it as marking where tears had once flowed. Behind thick pale green lenses, the man's eyes are fixed on the woman's tightly shut mouth. The smile vanishes. His expression stiffens. He turns to the blackboard and dashes off a short sentence in ancient Greek. Before he has time to add the diacritical marks, the chalk snaps and both halves fall to the floor. Late spring of the previous year, the woman had herself been standing at a blackboard, one chalk-dusted hand pressed against it. When a minute or so had passed, and she was still unable to produce the next word, her students had started to shift in their seats and mutter among themselves. Glaring fiercely, she saw neither students, nor ceiling, nor window, only the empty air in front of her.
"Are you okay, Songsengnim?"
asked the young woman, with the curly hair and sweet eyes, who sat at the very front of the class. The woman had tried to force a smile, but all that happened was that her eyelids spasmed for a while. Trembling lips pressed firmly together, she muttered to herself from somewhere deeper than her tongue and throat, "It's come back." The students, a little over 40 in number, looked at each other with raised eyebrows.
"What's she up to?"
Whispered questions spread from desk to desk. The only thing she was able to do was to walk calmly out of the classroom. Exerting herself, she managed it. The moment she stepped out into the corridor, the hushed whispers became clamorous, as though amplified through a loudspeaker, swallowing the sound her shoes made against the stone floor. After graduating from university, the woman had worked first for a book publisher, and then at an editorial and production company for a little over 6 years. And after that, she spent close to 7 years lecturing in literature at a couple of universities and an arts secondary school in and around the capital. She produced 3 collections of serious poetry, which came out at 3 or 4 year intervals, and for several years had contributed a column to a fortnightly literary review. Recently, as one of the founding members of a culture magazine whose title had yet to be decided, she'd been attending editorial meetings every Wednesday afternoon. Now that it had come back, she had no choice but to abandon all such things. There had been no indication that it might happen, and there was no reason why it should have happened. Of course, it was true that she'd lost her mother 6 months previously, divorced several years earlier still, had eventually lost custody of her 8-year-old son, and it was coming on 5 months since he had moved in with her ex-husband after a prolonged battle in the courts. The gray-haired psychotherapist she'd seen once a week because of insomnia after the boy's departure couldn't understand why she denied such clear causes. "No," she wrote, using the blank paper left out on the table. "It isn't as simple as that." That was their final session. Psychotherapy conducted through writing took too long, with too much scope for misunderstanding. She politely turned down his proposal to introduce her to a speech and language therapist. More than anything else, she lacked the finances to continue with such expensive treatment. As a young girl, the woman had apparently been,
really bright, something that her mother, during her final year of cancer treatment, had taken every opportunity to remind the woman of. As though, before she died, this was the one thing she had to make absolutely clear. When it came to language, that label might have been true. By the age of 4, and without being taught, she had a good grasp of Hangul. Knowing nothing of consonants and vowels, she'd memorized syllables as entire units. The year she turned 6, her elder brother gave her an explanation of Hangul's structure, parroting what his teacher had said. As she listened, everything had seemed vague, yet she ended up spending that entire afternoon in early spring, squatting in the yard, preoccupied by thoughts of consonants and vowels. That was when she discovered the subtle difference between the N sound, as pronounced in the word na, and when pronounced in ni. After that, she realized s sounded different in sa than it did in she. Making a mental run-through of all the possible diphthong combinations, she found that the only one that didn't exist in her language was e, combined with u, and in that order, which was why there was no way of writing it. Those trivial discoveries had been for her so freshly exciting and shocking that when, more than 30 years later, the therapist asked her about her most vivid memory, what came to mind was none other than the sunlight that had beaten down on the yard that day. The increasing heat on her back and the nape of her neck. The letters she had scratched in the dirt with a stick. The wondrous promise of the phonemes which had combined so tenuously. After starting primary school, she began jotting down vocabulary in the back of her diary, with neither purpose nor context, merely a list of words that had made a deep impression on her. Among them, the one she valued the most was soup. On the page, this single-syllable word resembled an old pagoda. P, the foundation. U, the main body. S, the upper section. She liked the feeling when she pronounced it. S, U, P. The sensation of first pursing her lips, and then slowly, carefully releasing the air. And then of the lips closing. A word completed through silence. Entranced by this word in which pronunciation, meaning, and form were all wrapped around in stillness, she wrote, soup, soup, woods. And yet, despite her mother's remembering her as really bright, no one had noticed her through primary and middle school. She wasn't a troublemaker, and her grades were not remarkable. Yes, she did have a few friends, but there was no socializing outside school. The only time she spent in front of the mirror was when she was washing her face. She wasn't excitable like other schoolgirls, and vague longings for romance practically never troubled her. Once the day's lessons were over, she would head to the local library and read a book unrelated to schoolwork, take a few books home with her, curl up under her blanket, and fall asleep while reading. The only person who knew that her life was split violently in two was she herself. The words she'd jotted down in the back of her diary wriggled about of their own volition to form unfamiliar sentences. Now and then, words would thrust their way into her sleep like skewers, startling her awake several times a night. She got less and less sleep, was increasingly overwhelmed by sensory stimuli, and sometimes an inexplicable pain burned against her solar plexus, like a metal brand. The most agonizing thing was how horrifyingly distinct the words sounded when she opened her mouth and pushed them out one by one. Even the most nondescript phrase outlined completeness and incompleteness, truth and lies, beauty and ugliness, with a cold clarity of ice. Spun out white as spider silk from her tongue and by her hand, those sentences were shameful. She wanted to vomit. She wanted to scream. It first happened in the winter when she just turned 16. The language that had pricked and confined her like clothing made from 1,000 needles abruptly disappeared. Words still reached her ears, but now a thick, dense layer of air buffered the space between her cochleas and brain. Wrapped in that foggy silence, the memories of the tongue and lips that had been used to pronounce, of the hand that had firmly gripped the pencil, grew remote. She no longer thought in language. She moved without language and understood without language, as it had been before she learned to speak. No, before she had obtained life, silence, absorbing the flow of time like balls of cotton, enveloped her body both outside and in. The psychiatrist to whom her alarmed mother had taken her gave her tablets that she hid under her tongue and later buried in the flower bed at home. And 2 seasons went by with her squatting in that corner of the yard, where she'd long ago got her head around consonants and vowels, soaking up the afternoon sunlight. Before summer arrived, the nape of her neck was already tanned dark, and an angry-looking rash broke out on the base of her nose, which was permanently slick with sweat. By the time dark red stamens began to sprout from the salvia in the flower bed, nourished by her buried medicine, a consultation between the psychiatrist and her mother resulted in her being sent back to school. It was clear that being cooped up at home hadn't helped, and she mustn't fall behind her peers. The state high school that she was entering for the first time, months after the letter announcing the new school year beginning in March, had arrived at their door, was a dreary, intimidating place. The classes were already far advanced. The teachers were imperious regardless of age. None of her peers showed any interest in a girl who spoke not a single word from morning to evening. When she was called on to read from a textbook, or when the students were told to count out loud during PE, she would look vacantly up at the teachers and, without exception, be sent to the back of the classroom, or have her cheek slapped. Despite what her psychiatrist and mother had hoped, the stimulus of social interaction couldn't fracture her silence. Instead, a brighter and more concentrated stillness filled the dark clay jar of her body. In the crowded streets on the way home, she walked weightless, as though moving encased in a huge soap bubble. Inside this gleaming quiet, which was like gazing up at the surface from underwater, cars roared thunderously by, and pedestrians' elbows jabbed her in the shoulders and arms, then vanished. After a long time had passed, she began to wonder, what if that perfectly ordinary French word in that perfectly ordinary lesson that winter just before the holidays hadn't sparked something in her? What if she hadn't inadvertently remembered language like remembering the existence of an atrophied organ? Why French, and not, say, classical Chinese or English? Might have been because of the novelty of it, because it was a language she could opt to learn now that she was in secondary school. Her gaze had lifted blankly to the blackboard as usual, but there it had snagged on something. The short, balding French teacher was pointing to the word as he pronounced it. Caught off guard, she found her lips trembling into motion like a child's. Bibliothèque. The mumbled sound came from a place deeper than tongue and throat. There was no way she could have known how important that moment was. The terror was still only vague, the pain hesitant to reveal its burning circuit from the depths of silence, where spelling, phonemes, and loose meaning met. A slow-burning fuse of elation and transgression was lit. The woman rests both hands on the desk. Her posture stiff, she bows as though she is a child waiting to have her fingernails examined. She listens to the man's voice filling the lecture room.
In addition to the passive and the active voice, there is a third voice in ancient Greek, which I explained briefly in the previous lesson, yes?
The young man sitting in the same row as the woman nods emphatically. He's a second-year philosophy student, whose rounded cheeks give him the air of a smart, mischievous kid. The woman turns to look over toward the window. Her gaze passes over the profile of the postgraduate student, who scraped a pass in pre-med, but didn't have it in him to be responsible for the lives of others, so gave it up to study the history of medicine. He's big and has a chubby double-chinned face, round black horn-rimmed glasses, and at first glance appears easygoing. He spends every break with a young philosophy student. They bat silly jokes back and forth in ringing voices. But the instant the lesson begins, his attitude changes. Anyone can see how tense he is, terrified of making a mistake. This voice, which we call the middle voice, expresses an action that relates to the subject reflexively. Outside the second floor window, sporadic points of orange illuminate the bleak low-rise buildings. The young broadleaf trees hide the bare outline of their skinny black branches in the darkness. Her gaze passes silently over the desolate scene, the frightened features of the post-grad student, the pale wrists of the Greek lecturer. Unlike before, the silence that has now returned after a period of 20 years is neither warm nor dense nor bright. If that original silence had been similar to that which exists before birth, this new silence is more like that which follows death. Whereas in the past, she had been submerged underwater, staring up at the glimmering world above, she now seems to have become a shadow, riding on the cold hard surface of walls and bare ground, an outside observer of a life contained in an enormous water tank. She can hear and read every single word, but her lips won't crack open to emit sound. Like a shadow bereft of physical form, like the hollow interior of a dead tree, like that dark, blank, interstitial space between one meteor and another, it is a bitter, thin silence. 20 years ago, she had failed to predict that an unfamiliar language, one with little or no resemblance to her mother tongue, would break her own silence. She has chosen to learn ancient Greek at this private academy because she wants to reclaim language of her own volition. She is almost entirely uninterested in the literature of Homer, Plato, and Herodotus, or the literature of the later period, written in Demotic Greek, which her fellow students wished to read in the original. Had a lecture course been offered in Burmese or Sanskrit, languages that use an even more unfamiliar script, she would have chosen them instead.
For example, using the verb to buy in the middle voice, I buy X for myself, ultimately means I have X. The verb to love, rendered in the middle voice, X is loved, ultimately means X affects me. There is an expression in English, he killed himself, right? Ancient Greek doesn't need to say himself. If we use the middle voice, the same meaning can be expressed in a single word, like this.
The lecturer says and writes on the blackboard, Diephtharthai. Musing over the letters on the blackboard, she picks up her pencil and writes the word in her notebook. She hasn't come across a language with such intricate rules before. The verbs change their form according to, variously, the subject's case, gender and number, the mood, the tense, of which there are various grades, and the voice, of which there are three distinct types. But it is thanks to these unusually elaborate and meticulous rules that the individual sentences are, in fact, simple and clear. There is no need to specify the subject, or even to keep to a strict word order. This one word, modify to denote that the subject is a singular, third-person male. The tense perfect, meaning it describes something that occurred at some point in the past, and the voice middle, has compressed within it the meaning. He had at one time tried to kill himself. Around the period her child, the child she had born 8 years ago and for whom she had now been deemed unfit to care, first learned to speak, she had dreamed of a single word in which all human language was encompassed. It was a nightmare so vivid as to leave her back drenched in sweat. One single word, bonded with a tremendous density and gravity. A language that would, the moment someone opened their mouth and pronounced it, explode and expand as all matter had at the universe's beginning. Every time she put her tired, fretful child to bed and drifted into a light sleep herself, she would dream that the immense crystallized mass of all language was being primed like an ice-cold explosive in the center of her hot heart, encased in her pulsing ventricles. She bites down on that sensation, the mere memory of which is chilling, and writes, "The Eftharthai," a language as cold and hard as a pillar of ice, a language that does not wait to be combined with any other prior to use, a supremely self-sufficient language, a language that can part the lips only after irrevocably determining causality and manner. The night is disturbed. The roar of engines from a motorway half a block away makes incisions in her eardrums like countless skate blades on ice. The lily magnolia, lit by the glow from the streetlights, scatters its bruised petals to the winds. She walks past the voluptuous blooms, straining the branches, and through the spring night air, which is thick with an anticipatory sweetness of crushed petals. She occasionally raises her hands to her face, despite the knowledge that her cheeks are dry. Passing by the mailbox, which is stuffed full with leaflets and tax notices, she slides the key into the lock of the ground floor front door, a ponderous, enduring presence next to the cold gleam of the lift. The flat is filled with traces of the child, things she'd refused to put away, convinced that one more court proceeding would be sufficient to get him back. The low bookcase next to the old velvet sofa is stuffed full of picture books they began reading together when he was 2, while various Lego bricks are kept in corrugated cardboard boxes decorated with animal stickers. She'd chosen this place many years ago, on the ground floor so her son could play freely. But he had shown no desire to stamp his feet or run about. When she told him it was okay to use the skipping rope in the living room, he asked,
"But won't it be noisy for the worms and snails?"
He was small for his age and delicately built. A scary scene in a book he was reading would raise his temperature past 100 degrees. And if he was feeling anxious about something, he would vomit or get diarrhea. Because he was both the eldest grandson by the firstborn son and the only male child on his father's side, because he was not so very young anymore, because her ex-husband unswervingly maintained that she was too highly strung and that this was a bad influence on the boy, the records of the psychiatric treatment she'd received in her teens were presented as evidence. Because her income, compared with her husband's, he had recently been promoted to the bank's head office, was both paltry and irregular. The hearing eventually resulted in a comprehensive defeat. Now, since even that meager salary was no longer forthcoming, mounting a further case was impossible. She sits down on the raised step inside her front door without removing her shoes. She puts her bag down beside her, which contains the thick Greek textbook and dictionary, her exercise book, and a flat pencil case. She keeps her eyes closed and waits until the yellow sensor light switches off. Once it goes dark, she opens her eyes. She looks at the black furniture hunkered down in the darkness, the black curtain, the black veranda sunk in stillness. Very slowly, she opens her lips, then presses them together. The lit fuse of the chilly explosive primed in her heart is no more. The interior of her mouth is as empty as the veins through which the blood no longer flows. It is as empty as a lift shaft, where the lift has ceased to operate. She wipes her cheeks, dry as ever, with the back of her hand. If only she'd made a map of the route her tears used to take. If only she'd used a needle to engrave pinpricks, or even just traces of blood, over the route where the words used to flow. But, she mutters, from a place deeper than tongue and throat, that was too terrible a route.
Chapter 3. It was the beginning of the summer when I was 15. It was a Sunday night, and the full moon kept on being momentarily veiled by the gray, uneven cloud cover. I was walking along the darkened road, looking up at that full moon, which was like a silver spoon that no amount of polishing will make shine. A moment came when the lunar halo, which was like a mysterious, disquieting code, spread a purple circle over the clouds. There were, at most, 3 bus stops on the road from the house in Tsuyuri to the crossroads just off the April 19th Revolution Cemetery. But I walked so slowly that it took me an awfully long time. By the time I reached the corner bookshop, the television screens in the display window of the TV and radio store were showing the start of the 9 o'clock news. When I entered the shop, the owner, a middle-aged man with broad, flat suspenders over his wrinkled gray shirt, was just getting ready to close up. I asked him to give me 5 minutes and hastily scanned the bookshelves for anything that might catch my eye. One of the books I picked up then was none other than the one I'm holding now, a pocketbook translation of Borges's public lectures on Buddhism. At the time, my impression of Buddhism was entirely gleaned from what I remembered from the Buddha's birthday festival I'd attended a fortnight before with my mother and younger sister. That day and night, I had witnessed a spectacle that, all things considered, could be called the most visually stunning of my as-yet short life. Lanterns festooned with petals individually fashioned from reddish-purple Korean paper were swinging in the sunlight in the front courtyard of the temple's main hall. To mark the occasion, the temple distributed meals of fairly bland noodles, which we ate in the shade of the Zelkova tree, in front of the offering space, before settling down and waiting for it to get dark. When the paper lanterns were eventually lit, I was enraptured, robbed of my senses. The reds and whites of hundreds of hanji lanterns swaying row upon row in the inky darkness, warm candlelight seeping serenely out from inside. "We have to go home now," my mother insisted, but I was rooted to the spot. On the Sunday morning when my mother announced that our family had to leave Korea in 2 months' time, why was it that the image of those lanterns came so clearly to my mind? Despite being vaguely aware that whatever impression those lights had made on me was not quite the same as religious awe, that night, when I went to buy an elementary German textbook and conversation tape with the generous amount of cash my mother handed me, I greedily clutched the Suttanipata, Dharmapada, Huayam Sutra lectures, and Yeolbangyang lectures, which had brick pattern covers and were published by Hyanamsa. I must have cherished some kind of nebulous and superstitious hope that transporting these books halfway around the world to Germany would keep the fate of my family safe. This slim volume of Borges made its way onto the list because of my pragmatic expectation that, insofar as it had been written by a Westerner, it would act as a very basic primer. At the time, I didn't pay much attention to the photo of him with his eyes half closed, hands clasped in front of his chest as though praying or regretting, reproduced in black and white on the upper section of the green cover. I read those books slowly and repeatedly during the 17 years I spent in Germany. Some nights, wanting nothing more than to run my eyes over the familiar contours of Hangul, I would sit a good long while with an open book and not turn a single page. Whichever book I opened, I could feel again the cool air of that early summer night in Tsuyuri. It was down to those books that I managed not to forget the moon that had been like a tarnished silver spoon. its purple halo, that it seemed a mysterious premonition of some unsettling happening. And so, the book that ended up being my favorite was the Huayam Sutra Lectures from Hyonamsa. Never again, in any of the books I subsequently read, did I encounter a system of thought constructed through such dazzling images. Whereas Borges's book was, as I'd expected, easy and general, so I'd flicked through it relatively quickly and then put it aside. Sometime later, when I went to university, I had to read his fiction and a critical biography in German. It was then that I opened this book again and read it with a fresh perspective. This morning, recalling once more this slim green book, I fetched it from my suitcase in the storeroom. Turning the pages, I discovered a note written in a rough hand, scribbled directly below a sentence by Borges. "The world is an illusion, and living is dreaming," it read. How is that dream so vivid? How does blood flow and hot tears gush forth? Below that, I could make out life. Life, traced in German, then struck out with a thick horizontal line. It was clearly my hand, and yet I had no memory of having written it. All I knew was that it was the same dark blue ink that German students use for note-taking. I opened the desk drawer and rummaged around for my old gray leather pencil case. Inside there was a fountain pen, just as I remembered. It was the same pen I'd used when I first moved to Germany. I'd replaced the nib countless times until I finally laid the pen aside during my second year of university. I took off the top, which was intact apart from a few scratches, and carried the fountain pen to the bathroom to wash away the dried ink crusted on the nib. I filled the sink with clean water and submerged the nib. The dark blue ink ribboned steadily through the water in a slender, wavering line.
Chapter 4. Me erotesais, me den auton. Do not ask him anything. Me alos poiesais. Do not do it another way. She sits without speaking amid the loud rumble of the students reading. The Greek lecturer no longer makes an issue of her silence. He angles his body away from the class and wipes the sentences from the blackboard, rubbing the soft eraser cloth over the board with expansive sweeps of his arm. The students are quiet until he's done. The thin, middle-aged man sitting behind the pillar stretches his back and thumps his fist against his vertebrae. The philosophy student moves his index finger over the screen of his smartphone, which he keeps by him on the desk. The postgrad stares at the sentences that are being vigorously erased from the blackboard, his lips part, their thinness in stark contrast to his bulk, and he reads the disappearing words to himself, his voice inaudible.
"Starting in June, we will read Plato,"
the Greek lecturer announces, leaning his upper body against the now clean blackboard.
"Of course, we will continue to study grammar alongside."
He holds the chalk in his right hand, and so uses his left to push his glasses further up his nose.
"Once human beings moved from communicating in silence, and only through unsegmented vocal expressions such as ooh, ooh, to creating the first few words, language gradually acquired a system. By the time this system arrived at its zenith, language had extremely elaborate and complex rules. And that, you see, is precisely the difficulty in learning an ancient language."
He chucks a parabola on the blackboard. The curve rises from the left-hand side in a steep inclination before sloping off to the right in a long, gentle fall. He taps his index finger on the curve's peak and continues to speak.
"From precisely the moment that it arrives at the zenith, language describes a slow, gentle arc, undergoing alterations that make it a little more convenient to use. In some senses, this is decline. This is corruption. But in other aspects, it can be called progress." The European languages of today have passed through that long process, becoming less strict, less elaborate, less complicated. When reading Plato, one is able to appreciate the beauty of an ancient language that had arrived at its acme many thousands of years ago. He does not immediately resume his train of thought, but is silent. The middle-aged man behind the pillar covers his mouth with his fist and gives a short, low cough. When he hems again, this time at length, the young philosophy student gives him a sidelong glance.
In a manner of speaking,
the Greek that Plato used was like a fully ripe fruit about to fall to earth. The sun rapidly set on the middle Greek that was spoken by the generations that followed him, and, along with their language, the Greek states too fell into decay. And so Plato represents one who stood and watched the sun set, not only on language, but on everything that surrounded him. She tries to listen attentively, but is unable to concentrate on each word. That one sentence sticks in her ears, like a long fish cut into pieces, its postpositions and word endings not yet scaled. In silence. Unsegmented vocal expression. Ooh. The first few words. Before she lost words, when she was still able to use them to write, she sometimes wished that her own expressions would more closely resemble inarticulacy, a moan or low cry, the sound of suffering through bated breath, snarling, humming in one's half-sleep to pacify a child, stifled laughter, the sound of two people's lips pressing together, pulling apart. There had been times when she had peered at the shapes of the words she'd just written, before slowly opening her lips and sounding them out. She had at once been struck by the incongruity of the flattened forms that resembled pinned-down bodies and her own voice belatedly attempting to speak them. She would stop reading and swallow, her throat dry, like those times when she had to immediately press down on a cut to stop the bleeding, or, on the contrary, to strain to squeeze out blood and prevent bacteria from entering her bloodstream.
Chapter 5. Voice. If you're reading this letter now, if it wasn't returned to me unopened, your family will still be living on the first floor of the hospital back in Germany. The stone building, said to have been built as a printing house in the 18th century, would by now be covered in pale ivy. Tiny violets would have bloomed and faded in the cracks between the stone steps leading down to the courtyard. The dandelions would have withered, leaving only a crown of pale, ghost-like seeds. The wild ants would be marching up and down the steps in regimented lines, looking like thick punctuation marks. Is your mother still as beautiful as ever? Still wearing those gorgeously patterned saris I always saw her in, a different color every time? And is your father, elderly now, whose cold gray eyes used to examine my own, still working as an ophthalmologist? And your daughter? How old is she now? As you read this letter, are you back at your parents for a visit, giving them a few days to dote on their granddaughter? Are you staying in the north-facing room that was yours as a child? Do you go for walks by the river, pushing the pram in front of you? Do you sit and rest on the bench you always liked, the one in front of the old bridge, take out some photographic negatives, which you always used to carry around in your pockets, and hold them up to the sun? The first time I sat with you, side by side on that bench, in front of the bridge, you reached into the pocket of your jeans and brought out two negatives, remember? You raised your slim, dark arms, held the film in front of your eyes, and looked up at the sun. My heart pounded unbearably, because I had seen you make the same gesture before. It was the day of my first appointment with your father, one afternoon early in June. On a metal bench in the hospital courtyard, where the lilacs were in full bloom, your black hair tumbling loose onto your shoulders, you were sitting and looking at the sun through pieces of film. The male nurse, with the curt expression, who had been sitting next to you, gestured for you to give him one of them. There was something amusing in the sight of two fully grown people sitting side by side and each squinting up at the sun through a piece of film. Unaware of my presence, concealed as I was behind the shaded glass door, the man looked away from the film and said a few words to you. You watched his lips move with a look of deep concentration. Just then, he leaned forward and planted a quick, awkward kiss on your mouth. This surprised me, as it was obvious even to a casual observer that the two of you weren't intimate. And it seemed that you were equally shocked, because you recoiled, but then gave him a swift peck on the cheek, as if to say that you forgave him. As if this were part of the generous etiquette of the friendship that had sprung up between you as you sat and looked at the sun together. You lightly got to your feet and took the film from the man's hand. He laughed awkwardly, his face burning. You laughed too. Still looking embarrassed, he sat and stared after you as you turned round and disappeared without a word. Of course, you couldn't have known what a deep impression those few minutes of perfect stillness made on my 17-year-old self. Not long after, I learned that you were the daughter of the hospital's owner, that as a newborn you had contracted a fever and lost your hearing, that after graduating from a special education school 2 years ago, you now passed your time making wooden furniture in a workshop at the rear of the hospital. Yet, this string of facts could not fully explain the chill I'd felt witnessing that brief scene. Afterward, every time I stepped through the hospital's main door when I had an appointment, every time I heard the buzz of the power saw coming from your workshop, every time I saw you from far off strolling casually along the banks of the river, dressed in work clothes, my mind would go blank as though I had suddenly inhaled the scent of lilacs. A tremor would pass through my lips, which had never yet known another's, like a tiny electric shock. In looks, you took after your mother. Your deep brown skin and black hair, which you usually wore tied up, were both attractive, but the most beautiful thing about you was your eyes. The eyes of a person well used to solitary labor. Eyes that were a soft mixture of earnestness and mischievousness, warmth and sadness. Dark eyes that moved gently over their object, never straining, taking in what they saw without leaping to any hasty judgments. Now would have been the moment to place a hand on your shoulder and ask for one of the negatives, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Waiting for you to take your eyes from the film, I contented myself with staring at your round forehead, at the strands of curly hair clinging to your skin, at the ridge of your nose that seemed to be wanting a small jewel, and at the round beads of sweat that had formed there. What can you see? You watched my lips intently as I asked the question. In that moment, I found myself able to understand the stern-faced male nurse. I knew you were simply trying to read my lips, but even so, I was struck by a sudden desire to kiss you. You brought out a notebook from the front pocket of your loose work shirt and wrote in it with a ballpoint pen. See for yourself. At that point, my vision was already fading. Your father explained his medical opinion that a premature operation would only serve to hasten blindness. He spoke slowly and carefully and kept his face deliberately impassive, refusing to betray any cheap sympathy. That strong light was harmful had not yet been proved, but he advised caution all the same, stressing that it was always best to be on the safe side. He advised me to wear sunglasses during the daytime when the sun's rays were at their strongest, and to have only dim lighting at night. Constantly going around in dark sunglasses like some celebrity made me feel self-conscious, so I chose a pair of glasses with pale green lenses for everyday use. Given all this, looking directly at the sun was something I couldn't contemplate, however much I used film as a medium. Aware of my hesitation, you wrote in the notebook again, later. Your hand was deft and exact. Presumably, you were well used to written conversations. just before it gets to the point where you can't see anything at all. Only then did I realize that you were fully aware of my prognosis. The idea of your family discussing my condition around the dinner table wounded me deeply, though it existed only in my imagination. I was silent. Having given up waiting for an answer, you closed the notebook and put it back in your pocket. We watched the river, as if that were all that was permitted. An unfamiliar sadness came over me, which I instantly understood was due neither to the hurt I had just received nor to the sense of having been affronted. Still, less was it down to fear or dismay over what the days ahead might bring. The time when I would no longer be able to see anything at all was still far in the future. This sadness, both bitter and sweet, was something that stemmed from your earnest face and profile, unbelievably close to my own at that moment, from your lips, which seemed to hold a barely perceptible electric current, from your black pupils, so very clear. That moment, when the river water scintillated in the July sunlight like the scales of a huge fish, when you suddenly placed your hand on my arm, when I trembled to touch the dark blue veins running raised over the back of your hand, when, gripped by fear, I finally brought my lips to yours. Has that moment now disappeared inside you? In front of that old bridge, does your daughter peek out from the pram and say, "Mama," and do you put the film strip back in your pocket and slowly stand up? More than 20 years have swept by, but certain aspects of that moment have not gone from my memory. Not only that moment alone, but all the moments we spent together, yes, even the most awful, are wholly alive for me. That which pains me even more than my self-accusation, my regret, is your face. That face. A mask of tears. The fist that slammed into my own face, harder than a man's, having spent so many years handling wood. Will you forgive me? And if you are unable to forgive me, will you at least remember that I seek it of you? I'm approaching 40, which your father warned would be the cutoff point, but I retain partial sight. Perhaps in another year or so I will be totally blind. It's been a long, slow process, and by now I need no further preparations. Like a prisoner taking one last drawn-out drag on the single cigarette he's been allowed. On bright days, I pass the long afternoons sitting in the alleyway in front of the house, drinking in the scene. People from all walks of life pass through this alley in a shopping district on the outskirts of Seoul. A teenage girl wearing earphones, her school skirt clumsily hitched up. A middle-aged man with a shabby tracksuit and a paunch. A woman talking on her mobile, whose stunning dress makes her look as though she'd just stepped from the pages of a fashion magazine. An elderly woman, with her white hair cropped short and a sparklingly embellished sweater, leisurely lighting her cigarette. Someone, somewhere, is swearing viciously, and the smell of kukbap wafts from a restaurant. A kid on a bike whooshes past me, ringing the bell as loudly as he can. Even wearing glasses with the highest power I could get, I still can't make out the details of any of these things. Individual shapes and gestures blur together, and any clarity is brought about only through the strength of my imagination. The schoolgirl will be mouthing the words to the song she's listening to, and her lower lip will have a small, bluish mark on the left, just as yours did. The middle-aged man's tracksuit sleeves will be grubby and worn to a shine, and the laces in his sneakers, which would originally have been white, would have turned a dark gray from months of not being washed. Beads of sweat will be trickling down the temples of the boy on the bike. The old woman looks like quite a tough proposition. Her cigarette will be some slender, dainty brand, and the twinkling shards of mother-of-pearl encrusted on her sweater will form the shape of a rose or hydrangea. When people watching and its attendant flights of fancy become tedious, I slowly walk up the path that leads to the mountain. The pale green trees undulate as a single mass, their flowers a riot of unbelievably beautiful colors. When I come to the small temple at the foot of the mountain, I sit and rest on the wooden maru outside the public hall. I remove my heavy glasses and gaze at the world's now faint contours. It's a common belief that blind or partially sighted people will pick up on sounds first and foremost. But that isn't the case with me. The first thing I perceive is time. I sense it as a slow, cruel current of enormous mass passing constantly through my body to gradually overcome me. Because my vision worsens rapidly as the light fades, I can't allow myself to stay sitting here for too long. I go home, change my clothes, wash my face. I have to go teach my students, you see. The class starts at 7 in the evening, which is your noon, the time when you best like to look up at the sun. I generally arrive at the private academy when it's still light, then wait until 7. Inside the brightly lit building, my movements are largely unimpeded, but even with my glasses on, walking alone through the streets at night is a burden. Around 10, when the class finishes and the students all file out, I order a taxi to the academy entrance to bring me home. What do I teach at the academy? On Mondays and Thursdays, I teach elementary ancient Greek, and on Fridays, an intermediate class reading Plato in the original. Each class has no more than 8 students. They're a mix of university students with an interest in Western philosophy, and others of varying age and backgrounds. Whatever their motivation, those who study Greek share certain tendencies. They walk and talk slowly, for the most part, and don't show much emotion. I guess this applies to me, too. Perhaps because this language is a long-dead one and doesn't allow for oral communication. Silence, shy hesitation, and reactions of muted laughter slowly heat the air inside the classroom and slowly cool it. And so the days go by here, without incident. Even the occasional memorable event is soon erased without a trace under time's huge, opaque mass. The year I first left Korea and went to Germany, I was 15. Since I was 32 by the time I made the return trip, my life at that point had been cloven into 2 almost exact halves, split between 2 languages, 2 cultures. I had to choose one of these 2 as the place where I would live once I turned 40, with all the changes your father had warned me that time would bring. When I said that I wanted to return to where I could use my mother tongue, everyone around me, including my family and my teachers, tried to dissuade me. My mother and younger sister both asked me what I planned to do back in the mother country. My degree in ancient Greek philosophy, so difficult to obtain, would be worthless there, they said. Not to mention how I'd need my family given my situation. I couldn't do it alone. It was only with great difficulty that I managed to persuade them to agree to my plan of spending 2 years alone as a trial period. I've been here for 3 times those initial 2 years now, and still haven't come to a decision. After that first autumn that I spent marveling at and moved by my mother tongue, which I had missed unbearably, winter came crashing in from all directions like a landslide, and Seoul began to seem more like a stranger to me, just as the German cities had once seemed. Shoulders hunched inside their colorless woolen coats and sweaters, people brushed past me with faces that spoke of long endurance, and even longer endurance yet to come, as they hurried along the frozen streets. Just as I had done in Germany, I looked on, an expressionless observer. And so here I am, having managed to avoid succumbing to sentimentality or optimism. The small talk I exchange with the unusually shy students, the fastidious principal of the Humanities Academy who somehow makes a profit by hiring a handful of star lecturers and keeps things afloat, and the part-time admin with the bobbed hair whose hay fever means she can never afford to be without tissues, whatever the season, provides me with some quiet enjoyment as I pass my days here. In the mornings, I use a magnifying glass to go over the sentences we will read in class that day and commit them to memory. I muse over the fuzzy reflection of my face in the mirror above the wash basin, and stroll leisurely through the bright streets and alleyways when the mood takes me. There are times when my eyes burn and suddenly start to water. When these tears, which are but physiological, fail to stop for some reason, I quietly turn away from the road and wait for the moment to pass. Is the sunlight full on your tanned face now as you turn and push the pram back the way you came? Does a bundle of bushy foxtail that you picked sway gently from your 2-year-old daughter's clasped hand? Instead of taking the direct route home from the river, do you stop in front of that ancient cathedral? Do you lift up the baby with your 2 strong arms, leave the pram with the warden, and step into the cool of the cathedral's interior? A place where the seemingly ice-steeped sunlight streams in through the stained glass windows in various gradations of blue. A place where Christ hangs on the cross without the slightest trace of suffering, his eyes lifted ingenuously toward heaven, and the angels step lightly through the air as though out for a casual stroll. Palm trees with dark and still darker green leaves sweetly unfurled. Bright-faced saints with pale blue-gray hair draped in paler blue-gray vestments. A space without a hint of sin or suffering, and which for that reason I'd felt was almost pagan. The Church of Saint Stefan. The late summer evening, all those years ago, when we walked there together, side by side, you wrote something in your notebook and showed it to me. You said that you'd grown up with a deep religious faith, but that, however much you tried, you couldn't believe in the existence of anything as extreme as heaven and hell. Instead, it seemed to you that spirits were real and wandered the darkened streets into the early morning. If such spirits existed, then surely God must also exist somewhere. I found it amusing that the foundation of the belief you claimed in the Christian God was not only illogical, but entirely unchristian, and, laughing out loud, took your notebook. I jotted down a demonstration of God's non-existence that I'd read somewhere and handed it back to you. There is evil in this world, and it causes the suffering of innocent people. If God is good but unable to address this, he is impotent. If God is not good and merely omnipotent and does not redress these things, he is evil. If God is neither good nor omnipotent, he cannot be called God. Therefore, the real existence of a good and omnipotent God is an impossible fallacy. Your eyes widen when you are genuinely angry. Your thick brows rise, your lashes and lips quiver, and your chest heaves with every breath you gasp. As soon as I returned the pen, you hastily scrawled in the notebook, "In that case, my God is both good and full of sorrow." If you are attracted to such nonsensical arguments, one day your own real existence will become an impossible fallacy. Sometimes, I put the question to myself using the form of Greek logic you so detested. When we take for true the premise that if something is lost, something else is gained, given that I lost you, what have I gained? What will I now gain through the loss of the visible world? There is, inevitably, something tenuous and unsatisfactory in the way the logical demonstration works, sifting all of humankind's sufferings and regrets, attachments, sadness, and weaknesses through the loose net of truth and falsity to obtain a handful of premises like a handful of gold dust. Boldly casting fallacies aside and proceeding along the narrow balance beam one step at a time, we see silence rippling like a black body of water past the net of clear, coherent questions we've asked and answered ourselves. And still, we go on asking and answering, even as our eyes remain immersed in the silence, in the menacing blue quiet that is constantly rising, like the black water. Why had I been such a fool when it came to loving you? My love for you wasn't foolish. But I was. Had my own innate foolishness made love itself foolish? Or is it that I myself wasn't all that foolish, but love's inherent foolishness awakened any foolishness latent in me and eventually smashed everything to pieces. Then, amatean, kateluetai, che, aletia. This sentence, written in the middle voice, states that truth destroys foolishness. Is this true? When truth destroys foolishness, is truth necessarily altered by the encounter, influenced by the very thing it has destroyed? Does a fissure form in foolishness when it destroys truth? When my foolishness destroyed love, if I claim that that foolishness was equally undone in the process, would you call that sophistry? Voice. Your voice. The sound I have not forgotten in more than 20 years. If I said that I still loved that voice, would you slam your fist into my face again? In the lip reading class at the special ed school that you'd attended for over a decade, you told me you learned to read lips and to speak German. One night, not long after we'd had this written conversation, it occurred to me, what would it be like to hear you speak, as you'd learned to do in that class? That summer, unbeknownst to my family, I'd bought a German sign language textbook and was spending every night practicing the phrases. I used my own reflection in the small mirror by the desk to practice, and an hour or so of this was enough to leave my back and armpits soaked with sweat. But it wasn't difficult or boring, not in the slightest. In fact, those nights were filled with a sweetness I know I will never experience again. It was around then that I realized for the first time that falling in love is like being haunted. Even before I opened my eyes in the morning, you would slip in under my eyelids. When I opened them, you instantly transferred to the ceiling, the wardrobe, the windowpane, the street, the far-off sky, and glimmered there like dappled light. You haunted me more persistently than I imagine any ghost ever could. In the small mirror by the desk that summer night, what was reflected was the upper half of my body as I sweated through my clumsy gestures and signs and facial expressions. But I recognized the glow of your face shimmering over mine at every moment. You speak to me. That night, I mumbled this sentence, which first came to me in German, out loud in my mother tongue. This immediately brought up an image, the pile of freshly cut timber in your workshop. Making sure that nobody saw me, I was particularly anxious not to have your father find out about it. I would hide myself there, among the timber, and watch you work. I never tired of watching you as you sawed, planed, and sanded planks of wood. If it was a big job, I would have time to become intimately acquainted with every nook and cranny of your workshop. I would put my nose to or run my fingers along the planks you'd stacked against one wall to dry. Fragrant cryptomeria, white fir, pine, which gave off a subtle scent from up close, woody growth rings resembling the arc of your shoulders. At the time, I vaguely imagined that your voice might resemble the feel and scent of that timber. But curiosity and musings weren't the reason I was interested in hearing your voice. Not at all. I was 17 at the time, and you were my first love. I was convinced I wanted to live with you. I believed we would remain together for as long as we had life in us. And this scared me. I knew I was going blind. Eventually, I wouldn't be able to see you. Eventually, I wouldn't be able to converse with you, whether through writing or by signing. A few weeks later, on a weekend afternoon when the weather suddenly took a turn and you were taking a break and making tea, I asked you a question. Carefully, unaware of any danger. No, with the innocence of ignorance. Could you say something, anything, to me, like you learned in your lip reading class? You watched my lips intently, then met my eyes with a dazed look. And so I explained that at some point we would live together and that I would go blind. that when I was unable to see, we would need spoken words. You couldn't have known how often I longed to turn back time, how much I wanted to take back those foolish words. Your face turned cold and hard, and you threw me out of the workshop where the scent of wood had been intensified by the drizzle. You wouldn't see me anymore. Of course, wouldn't kiss me. Wouldn't let me bury my face in your long black hair, the sweetly scented nape of your neck, or your delicate collarbone. Wouldn't let me slide my ardent hand under your shirt to feel your heartbeat. Steadfast, they refused to see me even when I loitered in front of your house from the early hours, slammed the workshop door shut whether my fingers got caught or not, and eventually, one night a few weeks later, punched my frantically beseeching face. We were both of us stunned. Without picking up my glasses, which had been knocked to the floor, leaving the faintly sweet-tasting blood to run down from my nose and lips, I clutched your leg. Shaking, you shoved me to the ground, eyes blazing. You suddenly opened your mouth. "Out! Now!" That voice. The sound of the wind scratching and whistling through the crannies in the window frame on a winter's night. The sound of a fret saw screeching over iron, of splintering glass. Your voice. I crawled forward on my belly and clutched your leg again. Did you really not know? I loved you. When, in some incomprehensible paroxysm, you picked up a piece of wood and used it to hit me in the face. When I fainted right then and there. Did you see? Did you notice the burning tears streaming from my eyes? Since foolishness destroyed that period of my life and itself along with it, I know now that had we in fact lived together, I wouldn't have needed your voice after I went blind. For even as the visible world would gradually have receded like an ebb tide, at the same time, the silence we shared would have gradually become replete. Several years after I lost you, I did look at the sun through two pieces of film. At 6 in the evening, though, not at noon. I was too afraid for that. My eyes burned as though a thin acid had been poured into them, and I couldn't hold on for long. Nor did I manage to learn what had so fascinated you. Only, I yearned for you. For the back of your hand, no longer by my side. For the deep blue veins raised up under your skin. Now, do you hold your child in your arms as you step out of the dark cathedral? Do you get the pram back from the warden, install your child in it, and buckle her in? Do you secure the stray strands of your hair, then set off home? Do you walk through those same streets where my 17-year-old self paced restlessly to and fro from early dawn, full of foolishness and agony, along the black cobblestone pavement? Every time the wheels of the pram are jolted upward, do you lay your hand on the child's chest to soothe her? Do you walk on, taking step after soundless step with your God, whom goodness makes sorrowful, on your shoulder? The sun rises 7 hours later where you are than it does here. On a day not so far away now, I'll be holding up pieces of film under the noon sun, and you'll be asleep in the darkness of 5 o'clock in the morning. A deep blue light, like that of the veins on the back of your hand, will not have entirely leached from the sky. Your heart will beat the regular beat of sleep, and now and again your eyes, which had burned and blurred with tears, will flutter beneath their lids. When I walk into complete darkness, is it all right if I remember you without this unrelenting ache?